This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, you'll hear a conversation that I had yesterday with Andrea Seabrook. She is National Public Radio's congressional correspondent. We recorded this interview, so that means that for this first hour of Focus today, we will not be taking calls. Well, I'm very happy to be talking this morning with Andrea Seabrook. She is congressional correspondent for National Public Radio, has worked for NPR since 2001, right?
I started actually in 98.
Oh, even before that.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a little messy.
Too many bios. So for a long time, she's done a number of things. She spent a year and a half as host of the weekend ATC, All Things Considered. And she has also hosted some of the other programs, Talk of the Nation. She's anchored live special election coverage. But has it been congressional correspondent more than any other thing?
Yes, absolutely.
That you've done? Okay. Mm-hmm. She's visiting, and we're recording this program. I'm sorry that we're not able to take calls as we usually do, but I'm really happy to have you here.
So I'm glad to be here. I love coming out to stations like this that are so involved in their in the community. Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that every beat has its particular challenges. Covering Congress now, I would think one of the challenges is it is such a big institution and there are so many people in it. What are some of the big challenges for covering Congress?
When you first start covering, it took me a year and a half to just figure out, you know, where the bathroom is, kind of thing. The Capitol complex is huge. There's 6,000 people in it. There's several barber shops. There's coffee shops. There's, you know, shoeshine stands, not to mention, you know, the floor of the House and the floor of the Senate and all the tourist destinations and so on. And then after a year and a half, when you start to have a sense of what you are covering and where to go, you have this creeping doubt, or at least I did, that what I was covering wasn't what was actually going on. And then it took me another year and a half to sort of get a sense of what was really going on. And I've spent my time since then trying to cover what actually happens in the Capitol. And that leads me to the real challenge of covering Congress. And that is, so much of what you hear on NPR, in the papers, on the TV news, what you hear is happening in the government has almost nothing to do with what is happening in the government. Because we, the media, cover what these people say they're doing all the time, we miss covering all the things they don't talk about that they are doing. And I've spent certainly this year and the last several years of my career trying to cover what they don't say rather than covering so much what they say.
And is that always different from day to day, or is there can you make some overarching statement about what it is that is really important that they're doing that they're not talking about?
Right. I can make some broad statements. I just had an hour with Alex Bloomberg and the Planet Money team on This American Life, and we've been rolling out some stories about this, a special project we've been working on. And I can tell you that almost every member of Congress or senator spends at least 2 to 3 hours every day making money, going to small fundraisers with lobbyists, calling friends, family, lobbyists, millionaires, trying to make money, sifting through donor lists, people who have donated to other members of their party, trying to get phone numbers to call them. There are phone banks in the sort of private offices outside of their public offices where they can go and make cold calls. They call it the power hour or phone time. A huge part of your representatives' time is spent trying to get money. Another big chunk of their time is spent meeting with lobbyists who have given to them or will give to them after that meeting. Together, those things probably make up 75 or 80% of what congressmen do, and they very rarely talk about those things. The amount of time they spend on the floor talking or so-called debating, which is never a real debate, or actually looking into policy or writing a speech, that stuff they farm out to staff. The real work of the congressman is asking for money and more or less selling access to themselves for money.
Well, let me ask you just a horribly cynical question. There are in the House, there are 435 mm-hmm. members. There are 100 senators. How many of those people in their career will ever do anything really important?
Well, you know, everything I've just said about the money is really horrible and cynical and mm-hmm. true, I'll tell you. On the other hand, there are wonderful people in Congress, and there are wonderful people in the Senate who are there for all the right reasons. There are people who aren't, obviously. But it's hard to quantify something about whether they'll do something really important, because there are little things people do that are very important to some people. I mean, in that sense, the democracy certainly works, the representative democracy that we have. There are people who go to Congress who I never cover, for the most part, because their whole career is dedicated to being on the Agriculture Committee only and working on agriculture issues. And because, you know, government reporting from Washington doesn't tend to have much, you know, sense of real serious agriculture issues, we don't cover it as much. And those people are doing incredibly important things for their constituents that you may never hear about in the national press anyway, because the national press is more or less obsessed with the politics of it all, or, you know, the health care bill or the national budget or these things. We will have a farm bill, by the way, coming up. The farm bill expires, I think, at the end of September, which means it'll be right in the middle of the cat fight going on before the November election. So that'll probably be extended into the lame duck session after the elections, just to follow that through. But the point is, there are very good people there. But the way we have things working leads to, I would argue, corrupt relationships in Washington.
Yeah. Well, I would like to believe, first of all, I'd like to believe that when people run for office, they do it because they have a sincere desire to do something good for their place that they live.
Yeah.
And that it's likely that they actually do manage to do things for their constituents. I guess I when I ask a question like that, well, does anybody do anything important? I guess I'm thinking of for the nation, or mm-hmm. or is it that really that you mostly what you can expect is that most members, they will be able to do maybe do something for their region or do something for their constituents. But in terms of being superstar players that are going to, you know, put their stamp on history, probably not many people get to do that.
Probably not. And right now it's particularly difficult because of this sort of system that I'm describing and have described in my reporting. It has made for ultimately a body or bodies, the House and the Senate, that is singularly unable to deal with the national crises of the day. I'm sorry to be the harminger of terrible news.
I don't think that's going to come as news to a lot of people who follow the news.
Yes, yes. It's not news that Congress can't deal with our unbelievable budget problems that we have, that we have seen coming for 15 or 20 years down the line, or that they can't deal with the problems with the No Child Left Behind Act, or that they can't, you know, there are just a million ways in which Congress is non-functional.
This, we certainly know, because people, when they talk about it and when they're asked about it, they say they're unhappy with Congress. The approval ratings for the body are low. We know that people say they're really unhappy that there seems to be a lot of gridlock and partisanship and nothing gets done. And it certainly does seem to be that way. I don't know how much, you know, perspective you have on how things have been, but do you think that, say, just in terms of partisanship, are things worse now than they have been in the past?
Yes. Well, okay. On the one hand, I say if nobody is beating each other up with a cane, then it's not as bad as it's ever been.
Which, of course, did once happen.
Right.
Let's
so,
not, yeah.
So we'll say that's the nadir of this, right?
Okay. Yeah.
We're not in a great phase. People have a lot of trouble having simple discussions or treating each other with the respect that you would afford a neighbor who has a different viewpoint on, you know, the dog catcher, the local dog catcher. We somehow, and I actually don't wholly blame the politicians themselves. In a sentence, you get what you vote for. And constituents in a lot of areas, people, normal people, have bought this line that our opponent is not our opponent, he's our enemy. That the idea that we are Americans first, united, and now let's have a discussion amongst ourselves about how the country should work, that's been lost. It's us and them. And there are a lot of reasons why that is good for the parties and very bad for the people. But it's hard to tell somebody who is utterly convinced that they need to lose their party loyalty and take another look at what you actually think. This is why it's so rare to find in the parties a fiscal conservative and social liberal. There are millions and millions of people in this country who are fiscal conservatives and social liberals, and there are almost none of them in Congress. On the other hand, it's very rare to find what was once called a compassionate conservative, a social conservative who would like to see money spent on the poor. There are millions and millions of people who believe that in this country. But the way that the parties have carved up the issues make it almost impossible to divide your own sentiments into issues. You have to choose. You are forced to choose in many ways.
So that it seems that that's a kind of chicken-egg question in the sense that, yeah, you think voters have become vulnerable to that kind of pitch, but the politicians have made the pitch.
Absolutely. And the reason they make the pitch is because it serves them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's much like the wedge issues that come up every once in a while, gay marriage or abortion or, you know, these sorts of things that, you know, when you find that when the people start to drift, suddenly one or the other party will bring up one of these wedge issues to snap everybody back into line. You know, remember, they may steal your civil liberties, you know, or, you know, whatever they have to say to get you to snap back to your sort of reactionary party loyalties. You know, it's interesting. I think one of the reasons Barack Obama won in 2008 nationally was because he sort of promised to end a lot of that stuff. And whether it's by choice or by inability, he hasn't been able to end a lot of that stuff. Although the way he acts is different than a lot of politicians.
My guest in this hour of Focus is Andrea Seabrook. She is the congressional correspondent for National Public Radio. She's visiting, spending some time with us here. We're pleased to have her. We're recording this interview, so that means we are not taking calls as we usually do.
Sorry.
We're sorry. We're sorry that didn't work out that way. When President Obama, boy, was President Obama when he was running, so 4 years ago, people did, I think, resonate with the idea of him and his message, and that was good for Democrats in the Congress, and they gained some ground. Then 2 years later, as often happens, the midterm roll around, people aren't as motivated. Probably the people who do vote are mad, and so Republicans made gains. They took over the House. So now we've come around again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the question a lot of people ask is, well, how are people feeling about the president? And what is that going to mean for Democrats in Congress? And will they run on his record or will they want to run from his record?
Well, it's very complicated because public opinion is very messy right now. For example, we know that the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, we know that people have very sort of moderate to negative views of that. We know that it's not terribly popular. It's not terribly unpopular. But among the people who don't like it, they really hate it. On the other hand, when we test, when the polls test any given piece of the Affordable Care Act, other than the individual mandate, we know that it's very popular, wildly popular.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
there's a lot of messaging in this. Yeah. There's a lot of PR. The polls can't, you know, you have to read tea leaves all the time. I think that's that makes it difficult for Democrats to run on that bill specifically. We know that Dodd-Frank, the Wall Street reform bill, has problems as well. It's gotten some bad messaging. It was weakened. That's particularly of interest in the Northeast and places where there are big banks. So the Democrats have a difficult time. On the other hand, it's clear that a lot of the Tea Party wave and this, you know, the summer of 2009, all those town halls, which ultimately led to throwing everybody out in November of 2010, or at least a lot of Democrats, and bringing in this huge class of Republicans, was a reaction to the election of Barack Obama and the subsequent move to the left of the Congress and the Senate to pass these big bills. Now, it wasn't a huge move to the left historically, but it was Democratic control of all the chambers. Okay, so the Republicans take the House. And what you immediately have in the same time frame, by the way, as the town halls were to the 08 election, the debt downgrade of the United States, the credit rating downgrade, the almost driving the economy off the cliff, that was in relation to the election of 2010. So voters, their immediate impression of this brand new Republican majority that was supposed to come in and temper the Congress in some way, their immediate impression is that they are willing to drive the country over the edge in the name of purity of ideology, basically. Mm-hmm. And that has stuck. That stuck through the fall. I think we hit the 9% approval rating, which really means that 91% of Americans have a low, are unsatisfied with Congress. They do not like what Congress is doing. It turns out by December, and we're just now talking a few months ago, the Republican Party's approval ratings were 10 points lower than the Democratic Party's approval ratings among all voters polled. So not just Democrats, but Republicans as well. And now we're getting this snap back. So Democrats are very emboldened going into this election. There is talk of perhaps the Democrats taking over the House again. There's talk of not losing the Senate, which seemed like a foregone conclusion just a few months ago. You know, with and I could talk about all the seats and the local aspects of that. But in general, the Democrats feel emboldened from a sort of reaction to the reaction to the election of Barack Obama. And, you know, just now we know that the guy at the top of the Republicans' ticket is not going to be a guy who is particularly persuasive among his own voters. So there's a lot of good feeling on the blue side of the equation right now.
Well, I think that some people have said, well, they wouldn't be surprised if the Democrats might pick up 10 or 20 seats. But is anybody really thinking that the Democrats could take control of the House again?
There are people who say they think that. It's also good PR to say that you think that if you're a Democrat. I think there are people who see it possibly playing out that way. I think what you can reasonably say is the Democrats have a chance. They are within striking distance in a way that no one thought they would be just a few months ago.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying about the reaction to the reaction to the reaction and about what's happened to that stream of the GOP that gets labeled Tea Party or you know, whatever you want to call them. But I also, you know, think that there are still places around the country where established Republicans are really seem to be surprisingly have their back up against a wall. And I guess I was thinking of two things, two guys in particular, Richard Lugar and Orrin Hatch, who are very established guys, have been in the Senate for a long time. And, you know, no one's going to accuse Senator Hatch of being a liberal.
No.
At the same time, they've been feeling they've been facing challenges from the right to the right of them.
Yeah.
They're not going to go quietly, but you have to wonder, you know, what's going on if guys like that have to be worried.
What's going on is a real struggle of identity within the Republican Party, and I think the struggle is between people who favor ideological purity of the party versus those who would like to see compromise. It's really about, do you compromise? Among a certain group within the Republican Party, compromise is seen as giving in to the enemy. That they would rather stop everything cold than compromise with a bunch of other legislators. And that really is what has, you know, Dick Lugar and Orrin Hatch have always had they're not liberals, as you say, but they also have been in the Senate a long time and they have many friends there, and they're willing to talk to Democrats about, say, stem cell research. In Orrin Hatch's case, he has always supported embryonic stem cell research against his party. Dick Lugar has been involved in international relations for many years, and that is not always, you know, the partisan thing that we think it is, you know, post the Iraq War. And so their challenges from the right have more to do with their willingness to compromise with Democrats than they do any real definition of conservatism.
So if we see those, I don't know if anybody's really thinking that they're going to lose and going to leave the Senate, but if we do see them lose, then that's just a further erosion of this style of person that we've seen in Washington. That is the person that recognizes, you know, you've got to work with people.
Yeah.
You can't just always be saying my way or the highway. But that what we're seeing is an erosion of willingness to negotiate.
Yeah. Yes. To legislate. The Capitol is a funny place, and it is what many people think is, you know, nasty horse trading is really the way legislating works. There's a lot of bad stuff that goes on, but there's a lot of stuff that has to happen behind closed doors for the betterment of the American people. It's not, and if, you know, if we lose the people who are willing to talk to each other and treat each other as Americans first, and partisans second, then we will be in the same situation we were in last summer. And I believe that the Republican Party in the House learned a lot from last summer, learned a lot from the crisis and the credit downgrade. You know, raising the debt ceiling. They learned that they can't play chicken with the entire economy and expect Americans to root for them. You know, that they need to pick more carefully where they demand, you know, ideology or ideological purity. And let me say, I feel sort of like I'm veering off into partisanship. There are a lot of great people within the Republican Party and many great people within the Democratic Party whose intentions are to do what's best for the American people in the best way possible and don't want to spend all their time fighting. But they're being drowned out by a fight that's going on, especially within the Republican Party right now.
I think people might be interested in hearing something about you. And I've, you know, read a little about you and your background, starting with the fact that when you were an undergraduate, you studied biology.
Yes.
Were you thinking at some point of being a scientist?
Yes. I never thought I would cover politics or government. I don't think I took a single political science course in college. I'm pretty sure I didn't. I did take one economics course. Since then, I've worked a lot to educate myself. I feel like I have three PhDs in Congress. But yeah, I know I never thought, and I think actually that served me well. I think because I'm not by nature a political junkie, The stories I tell about Congress, I am drawn to stories that aren't just incremental next step in the political game. I'm drawn to the bigger picture of the characters and their motivations and how the place works as much as what happens. And I think that's, that's that how it works often drives what happens. But yeah, no, I studied biology at Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana. And a great biology program. And I went and taught biology and chemistry and math in a English language private school in Mexico City for a while. And it took me about a year to figure out that I didn't want to teach biology. I didn't want to be out in the field counting birds, though I love birds. I didn't want to be in a lab. And so I redirected and went towards first audio and film and television, and then came back to the United States and got into NPR.
Yeah. So I was interested in hearing some more about this time that you spent in Mexico. You speak Spanish?
Yes.
How did you get interested in Spanish, in Latin American culture?
Well, I spent some time as a kid, a little time in Spain. My family moved to England when I was 15. My father's a college professor, and he did an exchange, and our whole family moved there, and I went to school there for a while. So we spent some time around, and then came back. And then in college, a wonderful professor of Spanish at Earlham named Kathy Taylor was putting, she had ran the Mexico program out of Earlham, and I went down and with Earlham's program and fell in love. I lived in a little city called Cuautla, which is in the state of Morelos, in south of Mexico City, in central southern Mexico. And I just absolutely adored the place. So I came back and went back and enrolled in UNAM, which is the biggest university in Latin America. It's in Mexico City, and one of the oldest. And took classes there, and I ended up, doing a lot of Latin American literature. And I love the people in Mexico. They have a calor, like a warmth that sometimes isn't, I don't know, that it's so refreshing and wonderful. Mm-hmm. There was, interestingly, recently there was somebody put out a list of the happiest countries in the world, the happiest cultures in the world. It turns out it didn't correlate at all with money or with, economic status of the country. And Mexico was up there. I think it was second or third. And I wasn't surprised because they'll take every opportunity to, sing and dance in the streets. And I just love that kind of verve.
So you never had the desire or inclination really to be a foreign correspondent? So
oh, no, I would love to go to the Mexico correspondent. In fact, I worked for NPR in Washington when I was younger. I went back to Mexico and worked for Philip Davis, who was then the Mexico correspondent. And that was during the Balkan War. And he was rotated to a different bureau for a while. And I got to man the bureau or woman the bureau in Mexico City for a while. And I would love to do that. But I'm very focused on Congress right now. I'm trying to write a book that sort of talks about what's wrong with the place from the point of view of this congressional reporter who spent about a decade there. And, if I manage to put it together, I'll come back and talk to you about it.
You took a little time. You had been covering Congress, then you took a little time off and did a stint as the host of the weekend.
Yes.
All things considered, I think about a year and a half.
Year and a half. Mm-hmm.
And then you went back to Congress. What was your feeling about doing that hosting? Did you do it for Ellen? Just thought it wasn't really what you wanted to do?
No, I loved it. It is so hard to do. It is much harder than being a reporter because at NPR, the hosts are not talking heads with producers that write their scripts. NPR hosts, like yourself, are very deeply involved in the production and the writing of their programs. And I found that if I was reading a book, it was for an interview for the show. If I was listening to a CD, it was for the show. If I was reading an article in the newspaper, it was for the show. If I was writing anything, it was for the show. And that is wonderful and beautifully exhausting. And at the time, I had a 2-year-old, and it just didn't work for me. I had to work a weekend schedule. She was in daycare Monday through Friday. You know, it just didn't work at the time. And, you know, later, basically personal stuff is what took it out. There's also the aspect that I'm an extrovert, but I'm a little bit of a lone wolf when it comes to reporting. And I love following my own curiosity as far as it will take me. And that's hard to do when you have 2 hours to fill in the weekend and an entire staff doing, you know, other things as well. So I really love reporting.
In this hour focus, the guest is Andrea Seabrook. She's a congressional correspondent for National Public Radio. We're happy to have her visiting. We're happy to be able to talk with her. We are recording this interview, so we're sorry we can't take calls for this part of the show.
It occurred to me that people could send me a tweet. My Twitter handle is @RadioBabe. If you tweet me during the show as it airs, then I will reply back on Twitter. I'd love to interact with the listeners. Just couldn't make the time work
That's
out.
That's great. One of the things that you got to do was you did a profile of Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, I've done several.
And she's, as people will recall, she was the speaker, first woman ever to hold that job, and certainly somebody who is very experienced and a very powerful political animal. And I don't know what people's perceptions of her are if all you see of her is news clips and talking heads kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Tell me about your impression of her, you know, to the extent that you really feel like you've got a sense of that you really know who she is.
Oh, I've spent a lot of time with her. I've done 3 or 4 profiles of her over the years. And one of the things that I found most telling about her was that when she was in school as a high schooler, she was in Baltimore. She's from a very powerful political family in Baltimore. She was in a debate class. She told me this story. And she and her friend were on the same team, and it was sort of one of these contemporaneous kinds of things where they had to pick a topic out of a fishbowl. And she reached into the fishbowl and she pulled out a topic, and it was, do women think? Do women think? That was it.
I cannot imagine today anybody having the nerve to propose that as a subject for debate.
I find it breathtaking. I find it breathtaking that in her lifetime that was even okay to put on the slip of paper to put
in
the bowl.
Yes, yes.
And she has gone from do women think to being the first woman speaker of the House of Representatives, the closest woman to ever the presidency, to the line in the line of succession, the presidency. And she is hard driving and brilliant politically, an incredible power broker, but also an incredible deal maker. Very open to listening to people's ideas. Always interested in new ideas. She barely sleeps. I was on a trip with her just recently, just in the last few weeks, and we went to, I don't know, she went to 6 or 7 events in 2 days in 3 cities across Texas, hopping by plane. She sleeps 4, maybe 5 hours a night. I think that happens to any woman who has 5 kids, or maybe even 3, or maybe even 2. But, you know, she had 5 kids and then began her political career. She is all business, and she manages to also be a great grandmother and a lovely person to spend time with. She has been vilified in many ways by the right. That's absolutely natural. I think, you know, the left vilified Tom DeLay. Anybody who is in power becomes the stamp of that party. And the way our politics has become so personal in this country, we automatically, you know, make that person a symbol of what's wrong or what's right. And I think, obviously, all people are more complex than that. And political decisions are more complex than that on both sides. You know, but it's true. She is a power broker in Washington and a very powerful, powerful one.
Are there ways you think that the nature of the criticism or the quality of the criticism was shaped by, influenced by the fact that she's a woman?
I will tell you what she told me about that. I asked her the same question. Mm-hmm. She told me in the same conversation where she told me about the fishbowl and do women think, she said she can hear a tone in the voice of people when they attack her on an attack ad in some district or on the floor. She did it. It's her. This sort of tone in the she and the her, which communicates more than just your average political attack.
Have you talked to other? She is going to be a particular target because she's the most powerful
mm-hmm.
woman, probably in Congress, or
certainly
she is among the most powerful women in Congress. One of the most powerful women in Washington, I'm sure. You know, would other women say the same, or have other women said sort of the same kind of things? That there's something, a kind of a nasty edge in the criticism that they receive, that they would say, you know, their male colleagues, they don't have to deal with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think all of the cultural stereotypes that we all carry are at play in political coverage as well. I mean, mm-hmm. I think you know what powerful women often get called for being powerful women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that can be very sexist. I mean, the gender roles are assumed, and crossing them is something you do at your own peril in this game. She would say all of this and then say, then again, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. And there are a lot of women who battle softly and with strength every day to be as effective as they can be in the Congress while skirting those stereotypes in both parties. Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington State, I believe, a Republican in the Republican leadership of the House, also strong family woman who is an incredible champion for her causes. There are many of them in Congress, but yes, it's harder. Why there are I don't know the exact percentages right now, but I think women make up something like 20% of the House and like 10 of the Senate, something like that, 10 or 15. And that's just can't be by chance. It, mm-hmm. you know, there is a perception that going to battle in Washington is a man's game, and it is in some cases, even in the press corps. I'll tell you.
Well, here's going to be my next question: was, you know, how is it in the Washington press corps to be a woman, and do you have to deal with some of that same stuff?
Yeah, I am never going to play golf at, you know, the fancy golf clubs in Upper Northwest with John Boehner, or even on the next hole, you know, before or after John Boehner, the Speaker of the House. Women aren't allowed in some of those clubs, just like Augusta. I mean, they're invitation-only clubs. There is a certain camaraderie that exists among some congressmen and the men who cover them or who have covered them for 20 years that I don't get let into. That said, I'm not sure a guy could ever get the story that I got from Nancy Pelosi when she told mm-hmm. me about the fishbowl.
Yeah.
Do women think? You know, everyone has their strengths.
Yeah. Well, going back to politics, or what will be maybe the big issues over the next few months, what do people think will happen if the Supreme Court decides the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional?
Oh, wow. There are much smarter people to ask that question of than I, or at least, you know, people who cover it more closely. Well, I can tell you that I expect an immediate backlash from the party that loses, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats. If the court upholds the law, Republicans will be very upset and claim it's an activist court. And if the court strikes down the law, Democrats will be very upset and claim it's an activist court.
Yes.
It turns out most people who study the court and study, you know, judicial action in general say that activist court is a relative term. So that itself will be a morass. It will be, no matter what the decision is. If the court strikes down just the individual mandate and upholds everything else, well, then we've got some serious policy problems, because everything else is dependent on the individual mandate. Keeping your kid on your insurance until 26, expanding Medicaid to include millions more people, paying for all of the preventive care that will bring everybody's costs down, economists say. All of that is dependent on younger, healthier people getting into the system, and just economically. And so, you know, politics will happen very suddenly. It's a good thing that it's getting decided, because the huge parts of the bill are set to go into place at the very beginning of 2014. That may feel far off, but when you have to gear an entire government bureaucracy to begin enrolling millions of new patients by the fall of 2013, well, we're starting to talk about a very close timeline. And if this isn't decided, then we would just have disarray.
The overarching thing, I guess, that's been so much up for debate here recently, whether you're talking about deficit, you're talking about budget, you're talking about tax policy, whatever it is, really the big question is, what is the appropriate role for government?
Yes.
And here, you know, we have two parties that are about as far apart on this as you can get, and seem actually, as time goes along, just to keep getting farther and farther apart. How are people talking about that?
You know, I think because of, you know, smart people like you, more Americans are starting to realize that that's the thing here, that we have to figure out as a country what we think is appropriate for the government to do, and then allocate precious, scarce resources towards what we think is appropriate for the government to do. To sit around and have a fight endlessly about whether the government should be providing student loans or some amount of health care or, a robust national defense, or, you know, whether to do those things or not, is getting us almost nowhere. It reminds me of adolescence. I mean, I think adolescence is about thinking a lot about who you are and not doing a lot of action. You know, you can have these great heartfelt debates with yourself and your friends about who you are and what you stand for and what you're going to be, and sort of the emotional turmoil, Hamlet soliloquy style, you know, and do very little. We need the government to do, whether it's on one track or the other. And I think we'll get through this, but it may take more of a crisis to get people to focus on the next step. I mean, I think in many ways the Depression was galvanizing for a generation or three of Americans who decided that it was appropriate for the government to have a role in keeping people from the most horrible, starkest poverty, what with food stamps and, you know, some amount of socialized medicine, which we have in the form of no one being turned away from an emergency room. I mean, basic sorts of things. And to go back and have that debate endlessly doesn't get us very far.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that the Congress reflects the national mood, and the problem is, I think, the American people, you know, whatever that means, we don't know what we want, or it is, or well, we know what we want for us, and I'm not exactly sure how you can expect these 535 people to be any more of one mind, or have it be any easier to talk about, you know, something as nebulous as common good. We can't do it. I mean, citizens can't do it. So, you know, can we really expect them to do it?
Well, I'm going to go back to the first thing you said. I'm not sure the Congress reflects the national mood or the national opinion, the public mood. And there are very basic reasons why. Mm-hmm. The way that congressional districts are drawn makes it a foregone conclusion in the vast majority of those districts which party will win, right? And so that election essentially happens in the primary. If you know that this district is drawn so blue that pretty much a Democrat's going to win, then the real discussion is who gets to be the Democratic candidate.
Yeah.
When you make the real discussion who gets to be the Democratic candidate, then you are appealing to the farthest left version of the district there, because they are the ones that are going to vote in a party election, a primary election. And so what happens is, well, if you think in your mind about a bell curve, you know, the centermost political thought would be right in the center of the curve. And by and large, most Americans are somewhere around the center, center left, center right, dead center, with the extreme views tapering off. So you would see a curve that is high in the middle and low at the edges. The way we draw districts and elect people in Congress, we have built an ideological spectrum that is exactly the opposite. Most of the members of Congress are far to the left or the right, and very, very few members of Congress represent the middle, where most Americans are. And so that curve looks like it's very high on the two ends and dips down to zero in the middle. And so, in fact, the Congress almost is the exact opposite of the national mood. It is the mood of the fringes rather than the mood of the nation.
Well, we got a couple of minutes left. I wonder if you have some idea of what will be on as we move through now the summer and get close to the election, what will be on people's minds. And, you know, if they spend the summer paying $4 for gas,
yeah,
that's what's going to be on their minds.
There's news out this week that that the gas prices may have peaked, back down.
We can cross our fingers on that. But do you have some sort of sense what you think people really will be thinking about? Or is that so just one of those things that you just say, well, you really can't know, and that's one of the things we know about elections, is that whatever's going on right then, that's what's going to be on people's minds.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the closer you get to the election, the more sort of crazy twists and turns things take. And the nature of politics and the media right now is that people, you know, these lawmakers are desperately trying to win the cycle, as they call it. In other words, do better in this one day of news than the other guy, which means that they spend a lot of time caring about stupid little things rather than the big issues that really should decide an election. For example, how are you going to solve the budget problem here out? We have huge problems with funding public pensions in this country, with funding health care in the future. You know, there are huge national problems that, if not dealt with, are going to leave a lot of people in a hole. I imagine we'll spend a lot of time talking about silly twists and turns. I think a gigantic portion of this election is going to be taken up talking about negative political ads. We already are seeing a flood of negative political ads like never before. I don't know how many people here in Illinois have seen many of them because it isn't one of the main primary states, or hasn't been. Mm. But in places that have, it's been unbelievable. The post-Citizens United Supreme Court decision, there have already been tens of millions of dollars flowing to production companies and television stations to run these horrible, biting, snide, sarcastic ads. And the fact that people are, that politicians on all sides are also raising more money than ever before means that they are buying what they call saturation. They're saturating the market with their ads. And so there will be a time, I promise, here in Illinois, when if you watch commercial TV, which I see no reason why you should be doing anymore, you should fast forward through the commercials or watch PBS. But if you're watching commercial TV, every commercial during a commercial break will be a political commercial because of those saturation market buys.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry. We're out of time.
I'm sorry to leave you with that.
Andrea Seabrook, NPR's congressional correspondent. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.